I think we can stop here today. But is this a true record? May it not be that time and space so disappear merely because the existence we are regarding is a fiction of the intellect, a fantastic nihil created by speech, which we strive to erect into a conceptual reality. We regard again that existence in itself, and we say, no. There is something behind the phenomenon, not only infinite, but indefinable, of no phenomenon, of no totality of phenomena, can we say that absolutely it is. Even if you reduce all phenomena to one fundamental, universal, irreducible phenomenon of movement or energy, we get only an indefinable phenomenon. The very conception of movement carries with it the potentiality of repose and betrays itself as an activity of some existence. The very idea of energy in action carries with it the idea of energy abstaining from action. And an absolute energy not in action is simply and purely absolute existence. We have only these two alternatives, either an indefinable pure existence or an indefinable energy in action. And if the latter alone is true, without any stable base or cause, then the energy is a result and phenomenon generated by the action, the movement which alone is. We have then no existence, or we have the nihil of the Buddhist, with existence as only an attribute of an eternal phenomenon of action, of karma, of movement. This, as is the pure reason, leaves my perceptions unsatisfied, contradicts my fundamental seeing, and therefore cannot be. For it brings us to a last, abruptly ceasing stair of an ascent, which leaves the whole staircase without support, suspended in the void. This is a very difficult paragraph. In fact, the whole chapter, I must repeat, is one of the most difficult chapters in the history of metaphysical writing. So when we are reading this, we must know that we are at the summit of a very difficult terrain, extremely difficult terrain. Sometimes we may ask even, why should we go to this difficult terrain at all? But
now,
Peter, that was quite clear. Yes, what are you saying? Tell me.
That it is very necessary to go through this intellectual exercise.
So, let us discuss this question first. The first question to answer is whether we are subject to intellectuality or not. If so, to what extent? It is true that all of us who are living in the modern world have some kind of intellectuality, all of us. The modern world itself has become intellectual. And since we live in this modern world, we share this intellectuality. It is true that we do not share the high level of intellectuality which exists today in the world at a very high level. See, for example, when we study the modern curriculum of studies, one of the most important elements of the curriculum is science. In fact, science is so much in our life today. Even this is science. This is science. Every aspect of our life, the fan that is running above our heads, and the air conditioner which is blowing cool air in our room, is a result of the scientific developments. Not only science, but science applied. So it is more complicated than science. It's an application of science, technology. Now this scientific development is a result of pure intellectuality. And this intellectuality began to take shape in modern world on large scale with the Renaissance. If you look at the history of the world, you will find the Renaissance, which started in about 1492 AD. That is the cutoff date which is regarded for Renaissance, 1492 AD. That is 15th century. So for the last 500 years, intellectuality has taken a kind of a turn, and it has been developing on larger and larger sections of humanity. It is not as if there were no other periods in history of the world where intellectuality was not developed. Intellectuality was developed at a very high level in different civilizations. Take for example, in India, the time of the Mahabharata. If you study Mahabharata not merely in gross terms, as you normally study, but if you study Mahabharata in detail, you will find that there is so much of intellectuality that every question of existence has been put at the level of intellectuality. Even the Bhagavad Gita, the way in which Arjuna puts the questions to Sri Krishna, and the length at which Sri Krishna goes to explain what he wants to explain, is highly intellectual. It is true, it is not only intellectual. There is also a blend of intellectuality with experience. There is a great meeting point in the Bhagavad Gita of intellectuality and spiritual experience. Even the sentence which I spoke to you the other day from the Bhagavad Gita, Nasato Vidyate Bhavo Na Bhavo Vidyate Sataha, that which exists, exists, and it cannot not exist. And that which does not exist. It cannot really come into existence. Now this sentence is a result of a great height of intellectuality. Great height of intellectuality. In fact, in a sense, you might say that while introducing this chapter, I took resort to that sentence at the very beginning by saying, first of all, nothing exists. And then I continue to develop the idea of existence. In other words, whenever you want to approach any problem intellectually, once you start on the train of intellectuality, there is no midway station. This is the problem. Once you start on the train itself is such that you go on and on and on and on until you reach the highest point that is possible. There are sometimes what we may call midway houses. You are on your train and then you get tired at a certain point of development, then you want to take rest. And then you say, now let us have a midway house. Now this is not impossible, but the nature of intellectuality is such that once you start on it, even if you are on the midway house, something remains in you to go forward and say, well, I must, even if I have to wait a little, I take a little rest, but again I start running. Now, there were periods, therefore, like the Mahabharata, where intellectuality was very high. On every subject, if you read in the Mahabharata, there is a shastra, there is a science. Vidur Niti, for example. Vidura was the prime minister. And he developed the political science of his time. Now, if you read the political science of Vidura at that time, and compare it with the political science of today, you will find that questions which were raised by Vidura were so high and so lofty, and the intricacies of the thinking were so great, that our modern political science seems to be a child's play in comparison. It was that height. In fact, as far as political science of today is concerned, it is of recent origin. And there is not much of complication as yet. We have still not raised such important questions of political life, which we ought to. For example, what are the basic roots of the solidarity of society? This is the most fundamental question of political science. How does a society remain united? Solidarity of society is a most important question of political science. And yet, that question has not been sufficiently raised and not answered. And yet, Sri Krishna speaks in the Bhagavad Gita itself and says that the highest ideal we should have is Loka Sangraha. Solidarity of society, Loka Sangraha. Now from this very word, we can imagine that in those times, the question as to how society can be held together was one of the most important questions which was being raised. And Sri Krishna had the answer to that question. How society can be kept in a state of unity? And his answer is very important. And he gives his answer both in intellectual terms and in spiritual terms. Again, if you examine the history of India, the kind of intellectual development that has gone into the making of Indian culture is amazing. It is said that India looked after three important categories of people. People who are imbued with imagination, but not highly intellectual. For these people, India gave 18 Puranas and 18 Upapuranas. They are full of stories and imagination, but not purely fictitious imagination based upon solid experiences of certain levels of experience. Now, this literature itself is so vast that even if you spend the whole lifetime, you cannot complete this. It is such a huge literature. So only for one category of people, India has produced so much literature. Now, this cannot be done without a very high development of intellectuality. Even to write one Purana is a very difficult task. Even to write one story is difficult, what to talk of hundreds of stories and all meaningful stories. Then there is a second category of people who are highly intellectual. And for these people, India provided three kinds of literature. One was the literature connected with the scientific study of everyday things. Verse, for example, was regarded as a very important instrument at that time. Not as much as today, but at that time, verse was a very important instrument of civilization. Now, the science of verse was developed intellectually to such an extent that one could, by following the science of horse breeding, you could judge whether that particular horse, by merely seeing a horse, you could judge whether that horse was capable of longevity, had the capacity of strength, had the capacity of agility, and had great intelligence in it. Because horses also have got different grades of intelligence. Just as human beings also have got these grades. Some horses are very, very intelligent, like Chetak or Pratap, or the horse of Alexander the Great, and so on. So how to judge a horse among so many horses which are lying before you, and select the one which was the best from all these points of view? And there is a science about it. Elephant, which was also a very important instrument, how to judge an elephant, that also was a big science. And there were experts in this field. Now, everyday things, how many things are there in everyday life? But for everything, there was a tremendous effort at that time to make everything an object of scientific study. Analyze it, come to the last point in the analysis, and build up from that last point to the superstructure. This was the effort. It is said there are 64 arts at that time. So, not only sciences of everyday life things, but also the arts. In fact, the woman of that time was required to study as many arts as possible. That was a kind of an Aryan woman, was trained right from her childhood into varieties of activities and artistic activities. And some of the descriptions, if you read, you find that today the kind of education that we are giving to our daughters is hardly anything as compared to the kind of conception we had for the daughter's education in those times. If you read the characters like Kadambari, Mahashweta and others, it is amazing the kind of training that was given to the Aryan woman. And this was all highly intellectual. So this was one kind of sciences. The second was the pure science, medicine, surgery, mathematics, astronomy, astrology, physics, chemistry, metallurgy, and several sciences which were developed up to a very high level of accomplishment. If you read Mahabharata from a point of view of metallurgy, it's an amazing science. What kind of weapons were made, which were used in Mahabharata and which were destroyed on a large scale? This could not be without a highly developed intellectuality. Then the third was philosophical studies. If you simply take account of the philosophical study that was made in India, it is so amazing. The philosophy of Nyaya, Vaisheshika, Samkhya, Yoga, Purva Mimamsa, Uttara Mimamsa, of Jainism, of Buddhism, of Charvaka, and these philosophies were made so precise that each one of them was put in the form of aphorism. You know, intellectuality comes to a high degree of sophistication when it becomes so precise that you can state your statement in as brief manner as possible. As long as the ideas are vague, you can be very vast and very long-winding. That shows that the intellectuality has not yet reached its high pitch. It is when you can say things so briefly and precisely that the height of intellectuality can be measured. And there is no philosophy in the world which was developed in this aphoristical manner. You have Nyaya Sutra, Vaisheshika Sutra, Sankhya Sutra. Every system of philosophy has sutras. Then sutras were commented upon, and a vast literature of commentaries, and these commentaries were further commented, and they were further commented, and they were further commented. So commentaries on commentaries on commentaries on commentaries on commentaries. And such a vast literature, from an intellectual point of view, it is so prolific, so vast, that even if you spend 500 years to study, it would not be enough. And that is still available. And what is available is a fraction of what was at one time available but destroyed. If you study the history of India, how much destruction has taken place. Now, all that was destroyed, out of that only a fraction has remained. And what out of that fraction which has remained, only a fraction has been studied in the modern times. And what you know of it is only that fraction. How many manuscripts even now remain unread? There is no time for people to read all that. It's so much available. Even if you go to big libraries of India like Saraswati Library, or Banaras Library, or some very big libraries, even in Jaipur and other places. So many manuscripts are lying and they are not read. We don't have manpower to read or to understand. So we have only read fraction of what is available, and what is available is only a fraction of what was at one time existent in our culture. Now, this is the amount of intellectuality that existed in India alone. Now, take Plato and Aristotle in Greece, and the kind of intellectual development which took place in Greece was so high, it is said that Plato reached such a height of intellectual thought that height has never been reached again. As somebody said, that all the rest of literature in philosophy that has been written in the West can be regarded as footnotes to Plato. The entire history of Western philosophy is nothing but footnotes to Plato. But that intellectuality, although that existed at a certain stage in the history of the world, none of these histories of intellectuality can be compared with the growth and development of intellectuality of our times. You might say that the intellectual growth of the modern time is unparalleled in the history of the world. This is the speciality of the times in which we are living. During the last 500 years, not only have there been great intellectual giants, but the number of such intellectual giants, if in previous times there were 10 giants, today there are 1,000 giants as compared to those times. This is the kind of extent. So this is one point I want to explain as to why we need to go into this kind of intellectual battle or intellectuality, because we are living in a world which is highly intellectual. And whether you like it or not, at a certain stage of your development, you will face intellectual questions. If not for your own self, for your children. The children of today are sent to the schools where the atmosphere is that of intellectual questioning. And they come up with questions in their minds. And today our difficulty is that most of the teachers and parents are unable to explain to children that kind of profundity of intellectuality which is now available in their books. Even teachers are not able to explain the kind of contents which are now given in the books. And this is only the beginning, actually, because take for example, recently we were reading, Anjali and myself, 11 volumes of Will Durant's History of Civilization. 11 volumes. One man writing 11 volumes of the history of civilization of the whole world. Now, what kind of intellectuality he must have reached to be able to grasp the history of the whole, not only of one country, but of all the countries of the world, and expressing that history in such vibrant intellectual expressions. He and his wife are the two authors of these 11 great volumes. Even to see these 11 volumes is an intellectual feast. You want to see them. Now, if this material goes down in the history books of our children, you can imagine what kind of revolution will take place in the minds of our children when they read all this material. And much more material is pouring, actually. The research activity which is going on in our country and our world is so great that every 3 years the knowledge is doubling. The amount of knowledge which exists is doubling today. So it is unparalleled in the history of the world. The mass of intellectual thinking and the extent of it. Pardon? Yes, yes.
That what she is asking is that when it's that we are all in the field of realization of the God. She feels that directly for the realization of God, will all this intellectuality help in the direct experience of the God, or can the direct experience be reached even without all this intellectuality?
It can be. It can be, and that is why we have to understand as teachers, as mothers, as guides, how to give a convincing answer to this question. It can be. But we should be quite sure that this is a part. There is another way of doing it. Because the children are in the intellectual atmosphere. How are we to convince the children that this is not the road, or this road is only one of the possible roads, and that too a not sufficient road? It is a dispensable road. And is it yet indispensable? That is also a question. Although it can be done, can you dispense with it altogether? These are the very important questions. And unless you pass through this, you won't have the experience of these fields. At least you should have the minimum, and what we are doing is only just the minimum. You might say the bare minimum. In fact, our advantage is that Sri Aurobindo has given the quintessence of the highest intellectual thought. If you crystallize and further crystallize and further crystallize and further crystallize, complete distillation, you might say, and the distilled thoughts, these 7 pages which are here in this chapter, the pure existence, you might say is a distillation of thousands and thousands and thousands of pages that could be written on this subject. So, that is why it is at once very difficult, extremely difficult, and yet we have the advantage that if you study these 7 pages and understand these 7 pages quite, it's very little, 7 pages. Although I'm quite sure that we get tired even to read 1 page of these 7 pages, it is quite true. But if you could do it, it will be like at one stroke, like as it were, you know, if there is a spring, and just you sit on the spring, and you are mounted to the top of Everest. How great is the effect and the result. Now this is one great boon, you might say, of this. But now to return to the question that you raised. If you want to attain to the experience of the pure existence on which we are now discussing intellectually, and that is our main concern is the pure existence, which we say speak of in terms of God. And you might say that our basic concern is to read the Lord, to read God. And is this the method? Is this necessary to read all this? The answer is that there are many other methods. But if you believe that those methods are quite easy, let us have no illusions about it. Besides, it is not that this particular method that you are following is going to give you that experience either. Even the method that you are following is a part of a method which is much larger than what is given here. But there is only one method. There is a method of Jnana Yoga, of which this is a part. What we are doing is, you might say, a part of Jnana Yoga. In Jnana Yoga, the important point is to have intellectual conviction of what is the truth and what is not true. Intellectual conviction of what is real and what is unreal. And to have a clear distinction between the real and the unreal. Once you are convinced, then Jnana Yoga says, this is the first step. First of all, you have to be convinced what is intellectually convinced as to what is real and what is unreal. After you get convinced, it is easier to concentrate upon the real. And this concentration on the real is again a very difficult task. In every circumstance of life, in every movement of life, you concentrate. And if you are not intellectually convinced, then it becomes even more difficult.
Sir, would that mean that, as Anjali just asked and you said, that we may not get that conviction by reading volumes and volumes of Sri Aurobindo? Thus, these 7 pages be sufficient enough to give us the understanding intellectually of the existence of the reality?
I believe so.
Is that?
I believe that these 7 pages are so crystallized that you might say that if you really pursue these 7 pages, no intellectual doubt would remain that God exists. And God exists of the nature that is described here, because the question is not only the belief in God's existence or intellectual conviction, but what kind of God is it? There are many wrong notions about God, and this chapter does not try to prove every wrong notion of God. But that which really exists, God who really exists as He is, of that God you can have an intellectual conviction. If you read these 7 pages quite thoroughly, I don't say that it is very easy to read these 7 pages quite thoroughly. And let us see, we are actually attempting to study these 7 pages. And we might succeed to a great extent. But as I said, that even in that part of intellectual Jnana Yoga, this is only the first step. Once you are sure, it makes it extremely easy afterwards to concentrate, to think of God in the way in which it is proposed here. If you really go into that movement, then it takes very little afterwards to jump into the experience of the reality. Of course, that also very easy does not mean really easy, but it is relatively easy. If you don't have this and yet you concentrate and pass through the process of Jnana Yoga, you might say it is extremely difficult, almost impossible. It's a very part of the process. And this is true of every intellectual yoga. It's not only yoga, integral yoga, but even if you take Advaitic Vedantic yoga, there also the intellectual process is tremendous. Buddhistic yoga, for example. In fact, if you go to Buddhistic monasteries, most of the time what they are doing is not experiencing what is prescribed, but only intellectually discussing, so that you are sure that Shunya is the only answer. That is, the whole practice of Buddhistic monasteries is nothing but to prove to the mind that all the intellectual questions can be answered only when you arrive at Shunya. And they have developed over thousands of years, since how many thousands, since Buddhistic time started, 2,500 years have passed. So over these thousands of years, very strict methods of intellectual argumentation have been found. And the propositions are made, counter propositions are made, this argument, counter argument, and everything is so expounded that every line and byline of intellectual thought is mapped out. Then it is quite easy to arrive at silence of the mind. Because normally when the mind is not silent, what is the reason? There are many reasons of the wavering of the mind. But one of them is the intellectual doubt about the ultimate existence. Ultimately, a time comes when you say, how do I know? And that creates so much of disability and wavering of consciousness that you have to arrive at a certainty before the mind becomes still. But there is one way of stilling. It's not the only method of stilling.
And after one studies a chapter like this, you see, being a human being, you have a lot of problems, and there are questions coming to you, how are you going to solve it, or should you go to an astrologer, should you go to a Baba, or should you go to a lot of 10, 15, 20 people, you try and get the answer for what you want. But I think after reading this chapter, one doesn't have to even go to anybody. You know the answer is within you, and you don't have to run around and ask people how to solve your own problem. You can solve it yourself.
You are quite right.
This
is wonderful experience.
Nice
feeling.
So the existence of God, you can't see it, you can't feel it.
That's right.
But you know there is somebody there in the place who's listening to you.
That's right.
In the end you feel, are you really connecting us?
That's right. That's right. Absolutely. It's wonderful.
Yes, wonderful.
So, no, but it is quite true. It is a fact. It's a fact actually that if intellectually you are sure that God exists, and the kind of God that is described here is not as a 7'7" bearded man living there. It's not that kind of God, but a real pure existence. Now, before I come to the next aspect of the question, you must know that one of the most important elements of modern science is expounded by Einstein. And every one of you has heard the name of Einstein. And his most important discovery is that whereas previously we used to speak of space and time, he said we are now to speak of space-time. This is one of the great discoveries he has made. This is one of the highest points of scientific thought, not philosophical thought, but of the scientific thought. Space-time. Meaning thereby that normally we have two strands in our perceptions of things. Perception of space, much of which we can see physically, which you can even measure by inches and feet and kilometers. And time, which you don't see as we see space. Isn't that so? Nobody sees time. The time is only experienced mentally by us. Whereas space, at least we can measure physically, but time is not physically seen by us, it is only mentally conceived. And time is measured in movement of events. So many events which are occurring, and when we think of this unfolding of events, we become aware of time. There was a time when we used to think that time is something, if it is 12:15 now here, it is 12:15 all over Delhi. There is one time which is uniform for the whole of Delhi, or let us say for the whole of India, or at least those portions of India which come under this particular level of the spread of the sun. In other words, you could say that simultaneously when I am talking to you a train is passing through Delhi, simultaneously at the same time, so many cars are speeding fast on the roads of Delhi, simultaneously. Now Einstein, while thinking of space and time, at the highest point he concluded that the notion of simultaneity is wrong. There is no such thing as simultaneity in time. For each point of space, there is a specific time. That is, time is not something like a cloud hanging over a large area of space, one cloud for the large area of space. For every point of space, there is a specific time which is peculiar to that space. Now, this is regarded as one of the most important ideas, which if not today, tomorrow, your children in classes 4 or 5, they'll start studying. Because this idea is now one of the highest points reached at the highest level of scientific thought. Already, 20 years ago, I had seen a book which had attempted to make pictures for children's book. It's not ordinary book of adults. Children's book to show them how space and time are related to each other in the way in which Einstein has seen it. So that for every space, there is a dimension of time. In fact, the effect of what Einstein has said is this, that space is to our consciousness three-dimensional. That is to say, there is length, breadth, and depth. Now, these are the three dimensions of space of which we are aware normally. And this is peculiar to our consciousness. A small creature like a bug may not have three-dimensional view of space at all. It only sees perhaps one dimension or two dimensions. Our senses are so located that we can see these three things at the same time. Even in art, for example, we know that actually depth is seen by a certain device. Otherwise, it is only two-dimensional. And attempts are made to give you instruments by which you can, even on the screen of cinema now, where you can have three-dimensional experience of what is presented on two dimensions. Now, if there is time for every space, then it is a fourth dimension. So, the modern science speaks of four-dimensional space-time continuum. This is the expression in modern science. The world as a whole is four-dimensional space-time continuum. Not space and time, but space-time, space-time. It is space-time continuum, but four-dimensional. So in this book for children, which I had seen 20 years ago, where objects were shown with a dimension of time, which you don't see physically, and according to Einstein, time is physical. It's not merely as we think normally, that we don't see physically time, but actually time is physical. Time is connected with speeds. And speed is a physical event. So space-time continuum, how to present to the children? In any case, our children, when they go to the level of MSc, even BSc and MSc, they are required to study this. If they take science as a specialization, they are required to study this. But a time will come when the knowledge will still expand further, so that what is being taught at the level of BSc will be taught at the level of lower levels of education, and they will still come down further. So, the age in which we are living is so highly intellectual that if the modern generation is not trained in high level of intellectuality, we will be unfit to live in the modern times. We won't be able to adjust ourselves with the modern times. And here there lies a very big danger for civilization. We intellectually develop to such an extent as this, and since intellectual domain is so vast, and the lanes and bylanes of intellectual thought are so multitudinous, millions of ways of thinking, of which you are not even aware, but as you start reading intellectual books, you will see hundreds and millions of ways of thinking and points of view. And if humanity is sunk into this huge network of millions of ways of thinking, then the question of experiencing will be so much postponed. You will be only lying all the time in the field of abstraction and abstraction and abstraction. You see, the great danger, human beings will be highly abstract, and the capacities of dealing with concrete and experience will be so limited. It is one of the great dangers of the civilization that is going to come up. Already we see that our children, when they are studying, if they are really studying, they become so abstract, we are obliged to give them such abstractions. Even in a subject like commerce, for example, how much mathematics is involved? How much graph is involved? The curves of the graphs and understanding of the graphs. Actual concrete realities are separate, but understanding through graphs and through mathematical formula. So how much abstraction has come in our thinking? It is true that most of the children forget about it. But if they are really studying it, truly, and ultimately, gradually, this burden is going to come upon humanity in a very large way. So, it is going to be a kind of a consciousness which will be highly abstract. And when the intellectual consciousness becomes very abstract, there is a great danger that its capacity to deal with the concrete becomes diminished. In humanity, once you develop one capacity, the other capacity becomes diminished. To develop all the capacities equally is a very difficult task. To make a philosopher a story writer is very difficult. To make a story writer a philosopher is very difficult. Some, of course, can be. But once you develop on one line, it is very difficult to be another. To put a philosopher on a political throne in the present time is very dangerous, because he may not be able to understand the concrete problems of mankind at all. His mind is so abstract that he is not able to read the concreteness of life. Of course, the ideal would be that he should be able to do it. But merely being intellectual, you cannot achieve that ideal at all. That is impossible. Something more is to be done after doing intellectuality. Something more is to be done to be able to reach that harmony. Now, at that time, you will ask the question, if there are millions of ways of thinking, are there any ways by which this can be abridged? Are there any ways in which you can distill all the different ways of thinking and arrive at the most minimum, most essential, which can be mastered? My answer is 7 pages of this book. It is as if we have visualized so many ways of thinking. Any way of thinking you take, ultimately, when you reduce to the most minimum, most essential, to what do you arrive? On the question of existence, in these 7 pages, you have all the essential elements. Therefore, you can see if you read the 7 pages, you don't need to go through millions of ways of thinking on this subject. So it is kind of a summary of summary of summary of summary of summary in Aristotle. The most still elements. Therefore, you must say intellectually, this is perfect. It is because of this reason at all that I venture even to speak of this before all my friends. If this chapter did not exist, I may tell you from my autobiographical level, that at one time when I studied philosophy, I had reached a conclusion that when I grow up and become adult, I started studying philosophy at the age of 15. By the age of 18, I had read quite a lot of it. And I had come to the conclusion that when I become adult, about 25, 30, 40, I will tell the world, do not teach philosophy to anybody. That was the conclusion to which I had reached, because there is no conclusion. Intellectual speculation is so wide, and there are so many alternative ways of thinking that you can never be sure as to what is really ultimately true. And if you don't have that conclusion, then what are you to do with it? It's all useless thinking. So I have come to the conclusion that I will advise everybody to stop philosophy altogether. It was at that time that I came to read The Life Divine. And when I read this chapter particularly, I was completely satisfied. And I said, now, if I have a chance to tell anybody that if you want to read the most intricate intellectuality on the subject of existence, I'll simply say, please read these 7 pages. You don't need to read anything else. Of course, these 7 pages contain a lot, which require a lot of background. Maybe 100 pages, 1,000 pages is a background, quite possible. But even this can be summarized. And what I'm doing with you is a kind of an impossible task, is to summarize the summaries of so many levels of thinking that, I read this chapter in about 2 hours at the time when I first studied this chapter. And I was so satisfied, and my experience was that I immediately attained to a complete stillness of thought after reading it. My mind was completely quiet. I was convinced God exists. And it was such a great relief. Shantam Siddhati Manaha. This is the one word expression which I expressed to myself at that time. This was in 1950. Shantam Siddhati Manaha. The mind sits silently. Now, this is only a part of the answer to your question, not a full answer. But let me continue. Since it's a very important question, I don't mind taking time on this. So I would like to say, first of all, that considering the intellectual climate in which we are living, it would be a very good thing for most of the people of the world to understand what intellect is, what are the methods of intellectual thought, and how intellect has millions of ways of thinking, and how they can be summarized most quintessentially and arrive at a most convincing conclusion. If this can be done, it will be a great benefit to everybody. If this can be done, it's very difficult, but if this can be done, it will be a great benefit. And yet, this is not indispensable. If you don't do this, it is not as if you can't achieve God. There are many other methods of attaining God. If Sri Ramakrishna could live in God consciousness, being entirely illiterate or almost illiterate, surely you don't need to study all this at all. There is a way of knowing God. But for that, first of all, there is one great need. And this is now I am expounding the method of devotion, which many people say it is a very easy method or comparatively easier method. And it is true, in a certain sense it is an easier method, in a certain sense. But to certain mentalities, and particularly the mentality of the age in which we are living, this is a very difficult method. This is perhaps an easier method than that method for most of us who live in the world of intellectual age. Because first of all, in the method of devotion, the most important thing is faith. You should have an utter faith that God exists. Secondly, you should be really like a child. Utterly like a child, like an infant. An infant which does not even think whether mother exists or not. In his consciousness, mother is not even a questionable, there is not even a thinking proposition whether mother exists or not. He is taken for granted to such an extent that the moment it cries, it knows there is answer. So you have to be like a small child, absolutely like a child. As Christ had said, that it is only if you become like a child that you can enter into the kingdom of God. And that is entirely true. Even among children, there are two types of children, of which Ramakrishna speaks. The cat child and the monkey child. And of these two, you have to be really like the cat child. The monkey child has at least to make an effort to catch at the breast of his mother. But the cat takes the child in its own mouth and carries. So the child has to do nothing. He simply carries. And it is true that God is really like that, basically. In fact, if you look at God really, if you ask the real experience of God, you really find that God is really like the cat mother. We are all in the mouths of our God, already. Only we don't realize, therefore we have problems. Otherwise, if you really know that we are in the mouth of God all the time, whether we know it or not, we are already there. In a certain sense, you might say that even if you don't do anything at all, you will be looked after. It is a fact. Just as the cat child has to do nothing, it will be looked after. But tell me, how easy it is to do nothing? It is one of the most difficult things, to do nothing. But the moment you start doing, remember, you are deviated. You really arrive at a point of really doing nothing, nothing absolutely. Don't think, don't act, don't move. Absolutely doing nothing. There is it is said, you know, Sai Baba of Shirdi, one disciple went to him and said, "Tell me, what am I to do?" He wanted to do sadhana, so he said, "Tell me, what am I to do?" His answer was, "Nothing." And it was an extremely difficult task to do nothing. But this is a real reality. God has a big mouth in whose mouth we are all located. And God is moving. And we are taken by Him, wherever He wants to take us. So, we have to have faith, a living faith, We are to be like a child. We are to be like a cat child, which is absolutely sure that God is moving with us, and we simply have to do nothing at all. At all, at all. Now, if you can do it, you don't need to reduce at all.
Doing nothing, would be doing nothing, or would it be doing everything but without anybody?
Really nothing. Really nothing.
Except to know that you are the kitten with the cat.
Even there you have to forget, because the moment you are right actually, if you reach that level consciously,
but
consciousness is plunged into consciousness. Even that what we call consciousness is no more the consciousness. So that awareness is plunged into awareness. In that awareness you have to be aware that you are carried by God. If you have that, you don't need to be bound with that right. Yes?
I was very occupied with some work and I was highly determined to come here also. But every morning I just yield myself to God. I only make 1 minute prayer that I am in your hand. Not even say it, but mentally it is there. I end up this place that I long to able to come. I try to, but I am not here to come. She rang up at 4 to 11.
Mm-hmm.
That it was difficult for me to get the something. Then she said to try to come in. She said, okay, whatever work I phoned up places and I found out that there are no jobs we get done only after lunch. So I immediately started to do this. Just like a cat child. Did not come myself.
To the extent to which we can do this, even in little ways like this, it's a tremendous help. And if you can do this, and Sri Ramakrishna's example very often is taken that he was almost illiterate, but he was like a cat child. It is because of this. And this is certainly a method. And afterwards, when he had attained, he spoke words which even the highest intellectuals could not understand. So that is another side. Vivekananda represents the intellectual questioning of the highest sign. In fact, the conquest of Vivekananda by Sri Ramakrishna, it was a real conquest. Vivekananda had rejected all the so-called pandits of his time, all the so-called religious leaders of his time, and said that all of them talk of God, but the moment I put the question, have you seen God? Nobody could answer that question at all. It was only Sri Ramakrishna who could say, yes, I see him and I can see him more vividly than I see you. This capacity to answer this question is one of the greatest events of modern India, of the modern world. That intellectual heights which could not arrive at a conclusion, arrived at a conclusion by the contact of this spiritual light. So the knowledge which bursts from that experience is capable of answering this highest intellectual question. So, when you rise from here, you arrive at a point, and when you reach that climax, when you begin to pour the knowledge, that knowledge again is of such a nature. For example, he said, God is both formless and form. Now, for him, it was a simple proposition. And this is a proposition which is very vividly made in this chapter of 7 pages. God is both form and formless. But intellectually, how are you to understand this? As Sri Aurobindo says, we arrive at a point which intellectually is untranslatable. We fall into contradiction when we try to understand this. But these were the terms which Sri Ramakrishna used quite easily, as if it was daily experience. For him it is nothing mysterious about it, nothing contradictory about it. So if you start with this, and if you can attain to it, then this path is entirely dispensable. There is no need whatsoever to pursue this path. There is also the path of Karma Yoga, where you don't need to have that cat child consciousness of doing nothing at all. On the contrary, it answers your constant boasting of energy of doing something, all the time go on doing. So those who are active like all of us, who can't even remain 1 minute quiet, for them Karma Yoga may be regarded as the easiest method. But even in that method, the effort is as great as the method which is involved here in the intellectual understanding. Now, what is the difficulty there? The first difficulty of that path is that you do the action but do not be bound by the results. This is the very first wisdom of Karma Yoga. There are many other later wisdoms, but this is the most elementary wisdom. Now, how many of us can act without being involved in the consequences, without, in fact, we might say that if we have nothing to no result, then we don't do anything at all. Our normal condition of consciousness is such that we do all activities only to produce certain results. And if you are to be told that, well, do not think of consequences, do not get involved in the consequences, then what remains for us to do? So the very first step of Karma Yoga is a very difficult task. The second step is even more difficult. That you do the action, realizing that you are not the doer of action. First was only connected with your doership, you do action but do not involve in the consequences. But now the second is, you do the action, but realize that you are not the doer of action. Now this is even a greater difficulty. And the third step is even more difficult. You open upwards, know that you are not the doer, do not be involved in the consequences. And the third thing is you open yourself from where action is really proceeding. The action we believe normally proceeding from our ideas, our imaginations, our desire for consequences and so on. This is what we think is the origin of our action. But when you know that you are not to be involved in consequences, when you know that you are not the doer of action, then you are able to open, then even this proposition becomes possible, that now when you know this, then you open up. Now this opening is a very difficult task. You just open. And when you open, you will find a tremendous force of action proceeding and just vibrating and going through you. It's like electricity. Electric wire in which electricity is passing has an origin. That origin is able to pass through electricity only because of the opening of electric wire. If electric wire had no opening, electricity would not pass through it. Similarly, there is an action of which we have today no imagination, no idea at all. But there is action, a tremendous flow of action. Lord Shorabindo speaks in the very first paragraph of this chapter, where eons of activities, myriads of things, a stupendous movement, a stupendous energy, which is already flowing. Now you open, just open up, and that energy will flow. That is the highest stage of Karma Yoga. When you open up, and that whole energy will flow, just, and then As Sri Aurobindo says, what is a flute? It is only a channel through which the wind blows. And it is the one who really blows the wind who makes a tune. Flute doesn't make a tune. So the whole life is designed by the one who plays the flute, the flute player. That is why Sri Krishna's picture is so wonderful, that he is the flute player and we are only flutes. And even these flutes are not we. They are made, fabricated by him. He is the fabricator, he is the wind and he is the blower. Now this message is also available. If you follow this, this is again not necessary. But again, once you have reached that point, then the whole thing may even flow from you. If you so desire, the entire life divine can flow through you without any effort on your part. It's quite possible. As Sri Aurobindo himself said, I am not a philosopher, not a philosopher, not a philosopher. He wrote all this with a complete silent mind. It was a flow of knowledge going straight on the typewriter. This is a speciality of this knowledge, that it is not a knowledge which has been intellectually thought out. It is a knowledge which has flowed from the Supreme Origin, who knows what is to be said and to whom it is said, to whom it is addressed. This is certainly addressed to somebody. There is no doubt about it. It has just flown. At this age, it knows very well what this age is. What kind of questions will be asked? What is the quest? Certain section of humanity is bound to ask these questions, which are answered here, in the way in which they are answered. And this has been done. So, now this being the background, in either case, there is going to be as great a difficulty as the difficulty you face here. Whether you follow the process of devotion, or the process of action, or the process of knowledge, you are bound to arrive at a stupendous difficulty somewhere, as much as we have here in this chapter. Now you have to make a choice. Do you want to have this or not? This is at least one process. I do not say that this is the only process, not at all. But I would again go one step further, that while this is dispensable, in a certain sense this is indispensable. If you want to be an ideal personality which the modern world requires, if it is only a question of your own realizing God, coming into contact with Him, that the moment you touch Him by any other method, others will be added to you. Even this knowledge will come to you automatically. As far as your individual question is concerned, this will be dispensable. But if you want to be an ideal person for the world that is being now coming up in the modern age, in the present age, then every one of us will be required to become a teacher. Everyone. Whether you like it or not, this is the one message which should be written on the sky for everybody, that everyone today will be required to become a teacher. If you don't become a teacher, it is at your peril. Your life will not be lived as happily as you would be able to live if you become a teacher. You may not be acknowledged as a teacher in a school, but as a mother, as a friend, as a counselor, as a worker, in any fields, you are required to be a teacher. And as a teacher, you will be required to meet different kinds of personalities. And some of them will be intellectual. Some of them, not all, but some of them will be intellectual. So in your dealing with those people, you will be required to have that intellectual equipment by which you will be able to deal with those people who will constitute one portion of the totality of the people with whom you have to deal with. Therefore, this intellectual equipment, in that sense, is indispensable. This is from the futuristic concept. It is true that just now, many of us are not required to do all this. It is quite true, because we are still in a transition. But the time is running so fast that within 20 years, you will be required to do this. That movement is so fast. And 20 years is not very far off. So, to be prepared for what is to happen to us 20 years hence, if we can do this, it will be very useful. If not to your children, your grandchildren are bound to be with you. And when you have to deal with your grandchildren, these questions will become quite prominent by that time. Because the movement is very fast. Today we are already speaking of the alienation of children. One of the most important problems of parents today is the alienation of children. Because the world in which the children are living today is beyond your control, beyond control of anybody. Even children are not in control of that world, parents are not in control of that world, teachers are not in control of the world, none. It is as if the world is moving and every one of us are obliged to salute that world as it comes up. Who can control television? Even those who prepare television films, they can't produce all the films. They can only produce a few. It is a whole totality which is working on the totality in which none can control anybody else. So it is a world which is, as it were, made so impersonal that nobody has control over it.
Only knowledge then.
Pardon? That is why the only thing by which you can really make your children closer to you is by the power of knowledge. It is when you are very knowledgeable, when you are able to answer the deepest question. Yes. So this is the time where we are now. In this time, if you really want to help your children, then everybody is required to have a very great equipment. Intellectual, emotional, dynamic. Karma, jnana, bhakti, all the three have to be developed whether you like it or not. It's now not left to humanity to decide whether I want it or not. If you do not have it, this a big machine has gone now forward, and if you don't do it, you are just thrown out. And you will stand crying in the world. That is all. But if you want to remain alive, participate, work actively, contribute to it, or at least even to vibrate like the flute, then these achievements, these equipments are absolutely necessary. And yet, these equipments should not make you proud because, as I told you, in all the three methods, the only condition of achievement is absolutely to be like a child, or to be really opening up, or to completely still your mind. Either still the mind in which there is no pride possible, or you become a child as in Bhakti Yoga in which there is no pride, or you open yourself completely in which the question of egoism does not arise at all. So the question of egoism is automatically out. So we have to reach a stage of getting ourselves equipped and yet not feeling proud at all, because the moment there is pride, neither of these three equipments are possible. So it is in that stage of consciousness, in that level, that we all are involved. Maybe that in our own present life, without all this integral perfection, we may be able to pull through this life. Although we may say that many problems will be certainly faced by you, and very often we won't be able to answer them. But maybe that we may pull through. But when you have to tell your children to be equipped, then you have to tell them, look, my dear children, you are now going on the wings, which are flying at a very great speed. And if you want to be capable of withstanding the tremendous flow of winds all over, then this kind of equipment is necessary. If you think that you are leading a life which is what it is now, and you will be able to carry through your life, do not have illusions. There was one day one person came to ask the mother a question. Is it necessary to compel anybody to learn? Because it might be assumed that from what I am talking of imposing upon children a big program of learning and teaching. So when this question was put to the mother, mother said, you have no right to impose knowledge upon anybody. If somebody chooses to remain ignorant, he has the right to remain ignorant. But tell him, if a child says, I don't want to learn this, I don't want to do this, I don't want to do that, make it very clear to the child that, look, you are free not to be get equipped with all that I would like to present to you. But if you do not get equipped, have no illusions. That being ignorant and yet to be able to face the world which is going to come before you is impossible. Make a choice after this. Decide that you don't want to face the world. You don't want to be anything in this world. You don't want to be able to confront the world. Make a choice. You don't want. Remain ignorant. And I will not impose it on you. But if you want it, then this is the consequence. Now you choose between the two. There are two alternatives. Either be equipped in such a way that you will be able to confront the world properly, rightly, majestically, royally, or you remain like a kind of a little thing in a, like a peg in the machine, and it will be crushed all the time by a machine. And then you will all the time cry against yourself, against the world, against everything. You have to make a choice. Now it is in that context that the present generation of young people, and the present youth is quite a long youth. From the age of 15 to the age of 70 is youth in the modern times. Isn't it? The modern youth is a quite a long definition. At one time it was only between 15 and 35. But now it is from 15 to 70. If the longevity is getting longer and longer, in any case up to the age of 70, you are required to work youthfully. It is even today, if you can't work youthfully up to the age of 70, you cannot really bear the burden of life. The responsibilities are so great that you have to plan that at least up to the age of 70, you will be able to work so vigorously as a young man of 35 would do. So that is definition of today. So at least to the people between the age of 15 and 70, I would say that this kind of equipment is very necessary. So now you make a decision. We can escape reading all this. And in fact, before starting it, I had asked you this question. Do we really want to go through this? It is highly intellectual. It is very difficult. And still somehow we were led into it. We said, doesn't matter, let us see how it is. Now here, when you taste it, it is tasting like what you are now feeling. That is it necessary at all? Why do you go through this at all? So, even now it is an open choice for all of us. If you say, well, not necessary, we can close this line of thinking, line of development, we can start something else, or we can close down completely. We are completely free. Or else, we go through this, since you have come up to this point, why not to take the further trouble? It may take 1 month, 2 months, and only 7 pages. It is not much at all. Only 7 pages. And what a boon. If you read the 7 pages and you are absolutely sure of what is written there, what a tremendous equipment you have. So I am sure that you all will choose that we shall go through this. Right? But for today we can close in any case. It's already 1 o'clock today.
Yes. When we talk about Mahabharata time, we need to say that we are moving at a much faster pace.
Yes.
Today, as compared to then.
Undoubtedly. To bring all the chariots to Hastinapura, to Kurukshetra, took many months. Today, Kurukshetra, you start somewhere, within 5 hours you can have a Kurukshetra. This is the speed today. Very fast. Today's movements are very fast. Yes. But you know, the paragraph which I read today is very difficult.
Maybe he could explain to us.
I shall only read again, but I will not explain it because that will take at least 1 hour. So, but I want to do it very nicely with all of you. As if we do alphabet, you know,
yes.
A, B, C, D, like that, so that every line becomes clear, and but with your help. That is to say, be concentrated, and we shall go through every line. And in doing so, you may not remain confined only to what is written here, because there are so many lines behind lines that we need to bring them out. But doesn't matter, we shall do it. But is this a true record? May it not be that time and space so disappear merely because the existence we are regarding is a fiction of the intellect, a fantastic needle created by speech, which we strive to erect into a conceptual reality? We regard again that existence in itself and we say, no. There is something behind the phenomenon, not only infinite but indefinable. Of no phenomenon, of no totality of phenomena, can we say that absolutely it is. Even if you reduce all phenomena to one fundamental, universal, irreducible phenomenon of movement or energy, we get only an indefinable phenomenon. The very conception of movement carries with it the potentiality of repose and betrays itself as an activity of some existence. The very idea of energy in action carries with it the idea of energy abstaining from action. And an absolute energy not in action is simply and purely absolute existence. We have only these two alternatives. Either an indefinable pure existence or an indefinable energy in action. And if the latter alone is true, without any stable base or cause, then the energy is a result and phenomenon generated by the action the movement which alone is. We have then no existence, or we have the nihil of the Buddhists with existence as only an attribute of an eternal phenomenon of action, of karma, of movement. This asserts a pure reason, leaves my perceptions unsatisfied, contradicts my fundamental seeing, and therefore cannot be. For it brings us to a last abruptly ceasing stair of an ascent, which leaves the whole staircase without support, suspended in the void. Rishi will do next time, all right?
Yes, kind of silly question.
That's right.
And so to feel that you have that the sentience of humans that you open up. And
That's right. Very true.
And then on the other hand, you say ki shunya mein se shunya nikal do to shunya nahi bachta hai. So no further explanation is left. What to explain when there is nothing? So that state is stillness. And what is the shunya called? Which shunya also defines the real the reality?
There is the difference of opinion. According to one, it is the absence of reality altogether. Another is the full reality. Both are the meanings of shunya. But I started my statement by saying nothing exists. Therefore, that shunya which is absolutely nihil is simply non-existence. So, what you see ultimately, real shunya is that which is all. Which is all.
Because I always feel very hesitant in,
but you are right.
Saying this word shunya for God. But I always thought that this should be God.
Veda says that reality is asat. That which is shunya. Even the Veda itself says that only here there was only shunya. Om was afterwards, even before Om was shunya. So that shunya is not shunya exactly, but it is such a reality that even to call it a reality is too limited.
In that consciousness, it is
shunya. In that sense, yes.
In that sense, it is
shunya. Not otherwise.
Not as nothing. All which is indefinable.
That's right. Yes? You see, for example, since you raised the question, and I don't like to leave a question in a halfway, those who have got this book with you, you can take this chapter, page number 28. You got another copy here, no? See, page number 28, the very first line, you get the word non-being. That is, non-being is shunya. Non-being is only a word. When we examine the fact it represents, we can no longer be sure that absolute non-existence has any better chance than the infinite self of being, more than an ideative formation of the mind. We really mean by this nothing, something beyond the last term to which we can reduce our purest conception and our most abstract or subtle experience of actual being as we know or conceive it while in this universe. This nothing then is merely a something beyond positive conception. Right? This is the meaning of nothing, of shunya.
It's so absolute that it is indefinable.
That's right. It is so
absolute.
So much being that even to call it being would be wrong, limiting it.
It's very silly, it's
okay. Yeah,
you're
making it.
You're
reading the same
thing. Really?